nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, only after Tehran returns to full compliance with the JCPOA. Blinken said the U.S. wants to start meeting its obligations again, but Iran needs to act first. He said Washington would seek to build a longer and stronger accord to address what he called deeply problematic issues. He, however, noted that it will take a long time for the U.S. to return to the deal. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was quick to react, saying it is the United States that should return to its obligations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal first. Zarif recalled it was Washington who violated the nuclear agreement, prevented supplies of food and medicine to Iran, and punished countries which abided by UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Therefore, it's the U.S. that should take the first step. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran as part of his so-called maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic. Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Tehran says it has lost trust in the Western members of the deal, and it will only revoke its measures after the U.S. removes its sanctions. On Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov echoed a similar position, stressing that the United States must remove its sanctions against Iran and comply with the 2015 nuclear deal, as it was Washington that withdrew from the accord. Some experts say Biden has been a warmonger and is not going to return into a pacifist overnight.
I mean, the point being that virtually everything he has done has been imperialist. He's a chief warmonger for the U.S. government. He is not going to turn into a pacifist and a logical statesman who cares about the well-being of people in the world. I mean, he's just never done that. And he's always been intimate with the defense industry. He has long-standing ties with the defense industry.
With the Biden administration not showing any practical and real interest in returning to the deal, questions arise as whether he will follow in his predecessor's track and maintain his anti-Iran pressure campaign, or will it put an end to its malign policy against Tehran, as Iran foreign minister put it. Iran, on the other hand, says the window of opportunity is closing very fast.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen-Palestine Organization. Participants discussed Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirmed that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance. The Yemen-Palestine Organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S., as the main supporter of Israel, is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdul-Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Almost 3 months have passed since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks in Qatari capital Doha. The negotiating team of the Afghan government accuses the Taliban of foot-dragging, but the militant group rejects such allegation.
The negotiating team of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is fully ready for talks, but the Taliban side has ignored to attend the meetings over the past 10 days under the pretext of being busy with their own meetings.
In the meantime, this top army official, who usually spends much of his time in front lines, also accuses the Taliban of expanding their attacks amid condemnations by the Afghan people and international bodies like the United Nations. That is why officials here warn that Afghan troops may intensify their attacks on the Taliban if they continue targeting civilians.
Our message to the Taliban is to either grab the current opportunity to bring peace or stop targeting civilians. Otherwise, we will pound their positions across the country and we will kill them one by one.
Despite all ifs and buts regarding the Afghan peace process, what war-weary Afghans want is lasting peace and an opportunity to forget about war, bloodshed and misery they have been suffering for over the last four decades.
We are tired of war. We have one wish, that is to see calm and security in our country. We don't care about either the government or the Taliban, but we want an immediate silence of guns here.
So far, many regional and international players, mainly the US, have declared their full readiness to support any move toward bringing peace to the country.
This comes as many here believe the Afghan peace process has now turned into a good pretext for some local and international players. This is because such a matter allows them to further interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and follow their own interests in this wounded land. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The UK government is mulling over plans to put some travelers coming to England in so-called quarantine hotels amid concerns about new variants of the virus.
As we vaccinate more people, it becomes more and more important that we protect against any new variants coming in. Once you have that protection and you don't have new variants in the country, you should protect against them.
Despite the high death toll, case numbers in the UK are slowly falling thanks to the lockdown. But the government is facing mounting pressure over when the restrictions, among them school closures, will be eased. As for the rest of Europe, well, they're worried about an outbreak of the so-called British variant within their borders.
Different European countries have different measures in place, lockdowns, curfews, but with their healthcare systems under immense pressure, they may have to enforce even stricter measures soon.
But the restrictions of freedoms already in place are testing people's patience. In the Netherlands, at least 150 people arrested Monday during unrest and looting in towns and cities across the country over an 8 p.m. curfew.
Het heeft ook niks te maken wat we zagen met strijden voor de vrijheid. We nemen al deze maatregelen.
What we saw has nothing to do with fighting for freedom. We didn't take all these measures for fun. We did so because we are fighting against the virus, and it's the virus which is actually robbing our freedom.
While the UK heads towards its mid-February target of 15 million vaccinations, across the EU, growing frustration with the pace of immunization. Last week, AstraZeneca told the EU it was falling behind on its supply target because of production problems. The EU Commission, in charge of approving and procuring the jabs, isn't happy.
This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return.
The delays will make it harder for the EU to meet its plan to vaccinate 70% of its adult population by late summer, leading to a deepening of the crisis across the bloc. The UK and European Union have survived Brexit and the financial lockdown of 2008. But it remains to be seen if they will survive COVID-19. Saeed Pariza, London.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Iran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
у нас едины.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then, of course, the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tendered his resignation, throwing Italy into a government crisis in the midst of a pandemic that has devastated the country. More than 85,000 lives have been lost to coronavirus as Italy's economy is falling deeper into chaos. After surviving two confidence votes last week, Conte has reportedly decided to quit because his executive risked being defeated in a vote over a contested report on the justice system in the Senate, where he no longer has an absolute majority.
President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella received this morning the President of the Council of Ministers Giuseppe Conte, who handed in the resignation of the government that he presides. The President of the Republic has decided to invite the government to remain in charge to handle the current affairs.
The government was plunged into crisis after former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled his junior partner Italia Viva out of the ruling coalition on January 13. Renzi had withdrawn his support over issues including differences on the COVID-19 recovery plan and the handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Conte is now expected to seek a third mandate from the President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, to form a new executive with a broader coalition. Should he fail to do so, Mattarella may decide to bring in a new prime minister or call for snap elections.
La risposta è molto semplice.
I'm going to make this very simple. This political crisis will result in more interest to be paid by Rome on its public debt due to an increase of the spread between Italy and Germany's 10-year yields. Whoever becomes prime minister next will have to implement tough reforms, including slashing health and social spending, in order to access the resources allocated in the EU's recovery fund.
On Wednesday, Italy's head of state, Mattarella, is slated to start a round of formal consultations with party leaders and other institutional figures to see whether a new coalition can be formed.
It isn't certain where this political crisis will lead. What is certain is that not even the world's worst pandemic in a century has persuaded the Italian politicians to remain united to face an unprecedented health crisis together. After the collapse of 66 governments in just 75 years of democracy, the country's future is now in the hands of President Mattarella. Max Civili, Rome.
Streets were deserted, shops were closed, and businesses were abandoned in Indian-controlled Kashmir as India celebrated its 72nd Republic Day.
What is there for the people of Kashmir to celebrate? Our special status was stripped, and so were our rights. The promises that were made were just a show-off. Our jobs, our land, and our opportunities are on sale. So what should I celebrate?
Amid suspended internet services and heightened security arrangements, authorities have held a symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
After revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude. And the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
According to a poll, 56% of Americans approve and 42% disapprove of the House impeaching Trump for a second time, which happened on January 13th when members of the lower chamber of Congress passed an article charging the former president with high crimes and misdemeanors for his role in provoking the deadly mayhem at the Capitol. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Majority in U.S. Won Senate to Convict Trump and Bar Him from Holding Office Ever Again. Stay tuned for the details, please. A clear majority of Americans want twice impeached former President Donald Trump to be convicted by the Senate and barred from holding office in the future. According to polling results released recently, the same day, the House of Representatives delivered an article of impeachment against Trump for incitement of insurrection to the upper chamber of Congress. The phone survey was conducted by Monmouth University Polling Institute, which interviewed 809 adults in the U.S. from January 21st to January 24th, roughly 2 weeks after a pro-Trump mob invaded the halls of Congress as lawmakers attempt to certify President Joe Biden's electoral victory. According to the poll, 56% of Americans approve and 42% disapprove of the House impeaching Trump for a second time, which happened on January 13th when members of the lower chamber of Congress passed an article charging the former president with high crimes and misdemeanors for his role in provoking the deadly mayhem at the Capitol. All 222 House Democrats voted to impeach Trump, but only 10 House Republicans joined them, and the partisan divide is reflected in the survey results. While 92% of Democrats approve of Trump's second impeachment, support drops to 52% among independents and just a mere 13% among Republicans. More than half, that is about 52% of the U.S. public, wants the Senate to convict Trump on the impeachment charge versus 44% of Americans who do not. According to MindMouth, the level of support among Americans for disciplining Trump is slightly higher now than it was when the former president was impeached for the first time in January 2020. Last year, 49% backed removing Trump from office via an impeachment conviction, while 48% opposed such a move. Now, 57% want the Senate to take action to prevent Trump from holding federal office in the future, compared with 41% who are opposed. When respondents were informed that a ban on future office holding must be preceded by a conviction, the support for a Senate conviction on the impeachment charge increased from 52% to 55%. There is somewhat more agreement that Trump did something wrong than there was with the first impeachment. But there are still a good number of Republican stalwarts who continue to stand with the former president regardless, said Patrick Murray, director of Monmouth. The January 6th riot was sparked by incessant GOP lies that the election was stolen, the false claims of Trump and his allies that Biden's victory was the result of widespread voter fraud and therefore illegitimate has had a lasting detrimental impact. The poll found that roughly one-third, about 32% of Americans, think Trump's defeat is attributable to fraud. Nearly 30 quarters, that is 72% of Republicans, continue to believe Biden won as a result of fraud. About two-thirds, that is 65% of the U.S. public, agrees that Biden won the election fair and square. Among those who still think Trump lost due to fraud, nearly two-thirds claim to want to move on. But one-third of this group, which represents 10% of the nation's adults, say they will never accept Biden as president. A number of ostensible leaders in the Republican Party continue to peddle this false narrative, and many more who know this claim is wrong have not been particularly outspoken in disavowing it, said Murray. Their fellow partisans in the American public are simply following that lead. The potential for Trump and his allies' lies to cause irreversible damage to democracy in the U.S. has prompted some lawmakers, including Representative Mondher Jones, to characterize Trump's Senate trial, which is set to begin on February 9th, as a life-or-death battle for the future of the country. Convicting Donald Trump to save our democracy is not a distraction, Jones tweeted recently, and added, it's essential.
European News Bulletin.
Uh,
I'm your host, Saeed Pereza. We'll kick this broadcast off here in England. Calls for getting the shutting down of Napier Barracks in Kent, southeast England, to completion is getting louder, described as the UK's first unofficial refugee camp. Residents say their living conditions are becoming unbearable and social distancing amid a COVID-19 outbreak is practically impossible. Banker Rahimi has visited the camp and sent us this report.
Fake blood being washed away, hours after activists threw it at the gates of the Napier Barracks in Kent, trying to highlight human rights violations taking place here. Security was tighter than usual when we arrived, and the occupants were reluctant to come forward.
Independent organizations, charities, and the residents themselves describe conditions here at the barracks as inhumane and unbearable. This was not what asylum seekers who risked life and limb to get to British shores were expecting. There have been protests, hunger strikes, and suicide attempts.
After an outbreak of COVID-19, morale deteriorated even further. Around 28 people were sharing the same space, toilet and shower, including those who tested positive. Literally trapped, some residents have slept outside in the cold for fear of catching the virus. But the government insists the barracks are COVID-19 compliant. On January 26th, the Secretary of State for the Home Department slapped down Labour MP Zara Sultana for demanding the dignity of the residents be respected and more suitable housing arranged for them.
Because of coronavirus, we need space for social distancing, which has been absolutely in place. These accommodation sites are in line with Public Health England guidance, as we've always checked guidance and worked with PHE throughout coronavirus when it comes to accommodation. I can see the Honourable Lady shaking her head. Perhaps she'd like to listen to the facts and not some of the sort of jaded views that she may hold herself.
That said, less than 24 hours later, dozens of residents were moved out of the barracks with very short notice and taken to a hotel nearby. These men all tested negative for COVID-19, but as they made clear, they were not allowed to exit the building and talk to us, even from a safe distance. There have been reports of them being threatened with delayed responses to their asylum applications if they are too forthcoming with the media. The atmosphere was sober in Kent, and people have mixed feelings towards the asylum seekers.
This is probably going to sound very unkind to say it, but if they left for better conditions here, all right, they may not be what they were expecting, but if they were good enough for the army in the old days, the barracks, why aren't they good enough for them? And that sounds awful, I know, and I'm going to get slated for saying that, but that is my view.
They're people, you know, they're trying to have a better life. Obviously, where they're coming from, the majority of them is horrendous. So I don't know what to do. I really don't know what to do. I mean, I like to think that we're at the end of the day, we're human beings going to try and cope with this as best as we can without blaming people all the time.
I know it's war-torn places and all that, but the law says that the first country they come to, they're supposed to seek asylum, but they're not. They're just coming straight through. This is where they want to get to because it's easy pickings. We're too easy on them. Sorry, but that's my opinion of it.
In an open letter to the British people in January, the residents of Napier Barracks described their living conditions and called for compassion. These men are finding it increasingly difficult to see light at the end of the tunnel, with asylum applications in limbo and their freedom of movement curtailed even more due to the pandemic. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Brexit was a defining moment in Britain's political history, and a real opportunity, many hoped, of the UK retaking its place as a leading voice on the world stage, free from the constraints of the EU. Now, a month in, has stepping away from Brussels yielded immediate results? Amina Taylor has a closer look.
After years of campaigning, round after round of tough negotiations with the EU, deadlines pushed back, and a no deal averted in the nick of time, January the 1st was a moment of triumph for those who both supported the UK's exit from Europe and for those who simply wanted to move on from the diplomatic drama. But flash forward a month into the UK's new relationship with Europe, and even though it's still early days, how's it working out? Brexit was touted in certain quarters as Britain's Independence Day, a real opportunity to retake sovereignty from the clutches of the European Union. But now, with some time settling in, just what are the realities of Britain's exit from the EU?
Brexit has clearly caused a lot of short-term chaos, basically, particularly with the fisheries exports and with the supply of food into this country. It's been a huge amount of disruption because of the extra red tape. The irony was that the Brexiteers said, we are going to lose all these regulations and red tape and we'll be free to do things, whereas in fact there's a whole mountain of stuff that companies have to complete and all has to be correct in order for really the most basic things to happen.
Boris Johnson and his cabinet have been adamant. This is a new dawn for the UK, a genuine opportunity to flex its political muscles on the global stage. Teething problems have dented this bonhomie somewhat, with businesses trading with the EU pointing to new obstacles.
What we haven't been prepared for, and I think this applies to any business in the UK, is all the extra costs that have come from this.
Industries like fisheries have been particularly impacted, with worried businesses taking their grievance directly to Westminster.
Once the customs stuff's done, it's back onto the lorry can then leave, done for the ferry, make sure we got our import declarations done as well, onto the ferry and on the other side. Could be another 30 hours extra for the shellfish in the water. It's not feasible.
The new trade deals that will replace anything lost in the split with Brussels have yet to publicly materialise.
All this nonsense talk about sovereignty and how now we're a free and independent country. On the contrary, we had great protection within the European Union. We were in the biggest trading bloc in the world, which not only meant we could trade freely with them, but also they had clout of the EU negotiating on our behalf and on behalf of the other 27 states for trade deals with other countries in the world. Whereas these days, just imagine what China and indeed the United States will think about Little Britain coming cap in hand.
There have been political complications too, with Scotland pushing ahead stridently for another independence vote as a campaign of reunification is being talked down in Ireland by unionists. Ardent Brexiteers will say moving away from the EU is more than about the nuts and bolts of red tape and temporary obstacles, but about a return to something greater, a renewed sense of pride that you can't put a price on. But for those battling with the new realities, they may well wonder if it's a price worth paying. Amina Taylor, London.
Stay in this country, the UK has added the UAE, Burundi, and Rwanda to a list of countries from which all direct passenger flights will be banned. The aim is to stop the spread of a new potentially vaccine-resistant strain of the COVID-19 virus, first identified in South Africa. British, Irish, and third country nationals with residence rights in the UK will still be allowed to enter the country, but must self-isolate for 10 days on arrival. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has met his Turkish counterpart in Istanbul to discuss a range of issues, including regional stability. The two countries touched on their joint efforts at maintaining peace in the Caucasus and in Syria, and also discussed the potential to work together on the situation in Afghanistan. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu criticized ongoing Western sanctions on Iran and reiterated Turkey's support for the JCPOA, also known as the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. A new law in Poland that bans abortion is in almost all cases is proving controversial. Poland's conservative government, which has strong ties to the country's powerful Catholic Church, supported the ruling, saying an unborn child is a human being. The new law, which came into force Wednesday, will only permit abortions in the case of rape, incest, or threat to the mother's life. Hundreds of pro-choice protesters took to the streets of Warsaw Thursday evening to demonstrate against the law, saying it imposes severe limitations on women's rights and freedoms. At least four people have reportedly been killed in a hospital fire in the Romanian capital, Bucharest. The fire broke out early Friday at the Matei Balz Hospital,
where COVID-19 patients are being treated. Vaccinations are also taking place at the same hospital, which had to be completely evacuated. Switzerland is a country which holds regular referendums. However, an upcoming vote on March 7th could see Muslim women banned from wearing the Islamic face veil by law. If successful, the vote would see Switzerland become the latest European country to discriminate against Muslims in law. Robert Carter explains.
Will Switzerland ban the burqa? That is the question being asked by many Swiss Muslims ahead of an upcoming referendum, which seeks a total ban on all face coverings in public. If successful, Muslim women who wear Islamic face veils will be banned from doing so after March the 7th.
Now, the text in the proposal doesn't mention Muslim face veils per se, only stating that no one shall wear face coverings in public spaces. However, the group behind the proposal includes members of right-wing political parties who were behind the already successful bid to ban Islamic minarets from being erected across the country in 2009.
In response, local Muslim activists have begun a Save the Niqab campaign to challenge the hate.
Islamophobia is as spread in Switzerland as everywhere in Europe. We know that there is a realistic chance for the niqab ban to be passed.
Speaking to Press TV, a representative explained why the ban would set a dangerous precedent.
Since the referendum was already signed by more than 100,000 voters to be even admitted to the ballot, and a recent poll suggests that 64% of voters will vote in favor of a ban, the law is highly to be passed. Adding such an Islamophobic and discriminatory ban to the Swiss constitution, which dictates to women how they should dress, exposes Switzerland to internal, or I would say international ridicule, and fundamentally contradicts the liberal and pluralistic values that this country is so fond of propagating. And if we were to ban everything that might have been out of force, then we would most likely ban a lot of things and not only the niqab.
Islamophobia has penetrated deep into Swiss society, with a recent poll finding that 63% of those questioned would vote in favor of a burqa ban, leaving Swiss Muslims with little hope. Robert Carter, London.
Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has supported Moscow's detention of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
All those investigations by this fugitive, who was accepted back in Russia, this German protester, that's just the beginning. And to him, I want to say, if anybody decides to fight, especially against the powers, against the government, against the president, decides to combat corruption, you better be crystal clean yourself.
Western-backed Navalny was detained for violating his parole in an embezzlement case. He is also on trial on assault charges, which he says are politically motivated. In other news, China has announced it'll no longer recognize the British National Overseas Passport as a valid travel document or form of identification. The decision comes amid a bitter feud with London over a plan to allow millions of Hong Kong residents a route to UK residency and eventual citizenship. Under the plan, as many as 5.4 million Hong Kong residents could be eligible to live and work in the UK. Hong Kong is a former British colony, which China reclaimed in 1997.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
It's that time of the broadcast. Outrage and fury at trading services such as Robinhood that have put blocks on trading the shares of U.S.-based retailer
GameStop, which has had a meteoric rise to more than $300 per share. The move has drawn the ire of celebrities, entrepreneurs, and politicians, such as American Congresswoman AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Ahmed Caballo joins me now to break it down for us. Ahmed, what is this David against Goliath situation?
Yes, David versus Goliath is an apt description. Some are calling this a revolution on Wall Street, the little man fighting back against hedge fund billionaires. And it all centers around something called short selling or shorting, which involves hedge funds betting on stocks that are struggling to lose their value and a way to make money off them. Now, GameStop, which was struggling before the pandemic, was seen as a prime target. However, there was this group called Wall Street Bets, which is on the social media platform Reddit, who have en masse bought the shares of GameStop, forced it to rise up, and basically forced these hedge funds and these billionaires to lose money. And in normal circumstances, they tell us that we live in a free market where all's fair in love and war. But these billionaires have not lied down lightly, and they've used their influence to force 212 Trading app, Robinhood, and a series of other apps to stop you being able to buy this share, meaning and only allowing you to sell, which has obviously caused the price to fall down. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that, but we've got a video from Dave Portney, who is going to explain a bit more.
What is going on Wall Street? The way they have absolutely cheated, stolen, robbed everyday people who have been investing with Robinhood and other E-Trade accounts and all this stuff by saying, hey, hedge funds are getting smoked. Billionaires are getting smoked. So we're no longer going to let you trade on certain stocks, GMC, AMC, NOC. We're just shutting it off. You can't buy those stocks anymore. You can only sell them. We are going to crash those stocks so all our hedge fund billionaire friends can get out and not get killed. It is one of the most remarkable, illegal, shocking robberies in the history, in plain sight.
So basically Robinhood and the like protecting the billionaires.
Protecting the billionaires. And this happened yesterday, and because of the backlash against what Robinhood and these other apps were doing, they were forced today to open limited trades on GameStop. But not everyone agrees. We do have those that represent the interests of the billionaire class that think that what these ordinary people were doing by buying stocks was not right. So let's play that video of someone who's complaining about ordinary people buying stocks and forcing billionaires to lose money.
The New York Stock Exchange does. So if anybody was going to control the listing and shut it down, it should have been them, but it wasn't. It was you. And the reason that they do it is very limited. They do it because they think there's evidence of fraud, or they think that there needs to be a material disclosure by the company that hasn't been made. And that's done to protect the investor. You check none of those boxes here because you don't control the venue. You didn't know about any information that GameStop or any of these other stocks needed to put out. You don't have any reason to believe there's fraud that you've articulated. And you're certainly not protecting these people who've been living the dream of making money, especially at the expense of the big guys. So why should people believe you did this for the right reasons?
Well, we have no choice. We have to comply with all financial requirements. And
the SEC hasn't said you had to do this.
Well, lots of brokers have to...
Good question there. Why should people believe you did this for the right reasons?
Yeah, that was a wrong video. That was actually Christopher Kumi from CNN. He was drilling the Robinhood CEO, Vlad Tenev, about what he's done. And as you could see, he was umming and ahhing, and he didn't really have an explanation for what he did or why he did it. And there is no explanation. There is no justification. It seems like that this was done at the behest of those who have a lot of money and therefore have a lot of influence. Now, we are going to play the video of someone complaining on behalf of the billionaires that we were meant to play a moment ago. Let's play that.
The reason the market is doing what it's doing is people are sitting at home getting the checks from the government, okay? And this fair share is a concept. It's just a way of attacking wealthy people, and, you know, I think it's inappropriate. We all got to work together and pull together.
people are trying to make money. He calls it a way of attacking wealthy people.
Yeah, exactly. Now, because of the uproar on social media, this has been one of the number one trending topics for the last 24 hours. We've had some backlash from politicians. We've got this tweet from AOC. She says, "Got to admit, it's really something to see Wall Street, as with a long history of treating our economy as a casino, complain about a message board of posters also treating the market as a casino." And some people are mentioning that the 2008 crash was not a result of people on Reddit, was a result of these hedge fund billionaires who were basically gambling with everyone's future, gambling with people's mortgages, gambling with people's welfare and their livelihoods. Now, Joe McCain says this: "This is how the system is rigged. The elites aren't even trying to hide it. Robin Hood, whose revenue is largely tied to Citadel, restricts trading in GME, AMC, and NOK, which is Nokia. Users can only sell, not buy." Now, this is one of the rumors online. It hasn't been verified yet, but some of these hedge funds, one of them is Citadel, there is allegations they have financial links to some of these apps that have taken this decision to stop trading for these stocks. Now, final tweet from Rep. Jeff Duncan says this: "Tonight, I'm leading a bipartisan group of lawmakers in calling for the SEC to investigate Robinhood and other financial institutions for their unprecedented and harmful actions against individual investors. Wall Street shouldn't get to play by a different set of rules. GME."
This is a story that's going to stay with us for a while, Ahmed, and I'm sure you'll be following it for us. Let's go all the way down under now, and a gang of Australian neo-Nazis threatening to do what neo-Nazis do.
Yeah, so on Australia Day, which is a controversial day celebrated by some Australians of when Australia was quote-unquote found, even though there was already Indigenous Aboriginal people living in Australia for thousands of years before the European settlers ever set foot on there. Now, this has caused some outrage because around 30 men burnt crosses, called themselves the Australian Ku Klux Klan, made chants about the white race being superior, and it's caused, as you can imagine, a bit of an uproar on social media. But some people are starting to make other points and saying that when a country doesn't come to terms with its own history, When it talks about a day where the Indigenous people of Australia were ethnically cleansed, where crimes against humanity were committed against them, where it was essentially an invasion by a European settler colonial entity to take over the land, to take over the resources, when that history is never really acknowledged or taught about in the right way, then of course you're going to get people from that country that think that the white race is superior and that white supremacy is the way forward. Now there have been some tweets condemning these men and what they represent, and some are saying that actually the Christchurch shooter himself was Australian, and that Australia and that part of the world needs to come to terms with a rising threat from the neo-Nazis. So Anti versus Evil says, "Australia, we have a problem. This is a neo-Nazi gathering in regional Victoria. The New Zealand shooter who killed 51 people was an Australian born from Grafton, NSW, and Aussie PM Morrison does nothing." Drew says, "They've always been here, but since the Reclaim Australia days, they've been constantly reinventing themselves each time, denying they are Nazis a little less, till now finally they fully admit it."
Well, Ahmed, we'll have to see what the Australian authorities will do about these people. Ahmed Caballo with those stories. Ahmed, thank you. And that's all the time we have for this broadcast. Thanks. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The big and overwhelming problems of American society.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
We should notice that the big problems that have engulfed our main enemy is the U.S. government and regime, are not comparable to ours. The U.S. problem with us is that it can neither eliminate us nor make us surrender. It is trying to make us give in to its demands or eliminate and destroy us, but it cannot do neither of the two. That is why it is upset. Therefore, in my opinion, patience, stability, resistance, and God-willing jihadi work are our responsibilities. Well, our present administration is at the end of its term. In the past 7 years, they have accomplished certain tasks, and they have done whatever they could. After that, by Allah's favor, there will be a fresh administration, and I hope that it will do things in a more serious way, God willing. Some divisions of the administration have really done well in their term. One could not perhaps say the same thing for all divisions, but in some divisions they have done good tasks. Therefore, by Allah's favor and grace, we will continue our work. We will move forward the path, and the Iranian nation will be victorious.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
I wish to say something about Muharram. There are many debates about Muharram. People have been speaking about Muharram for a long time. Well, they will hold the mourning ceremonies one way or another. But what I want to stress is that in the mourning ceremonies, the main criteria is what medical experts, the National Anti-Corona Headquarters, announced to us.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Thank you.
Africa Today.
Division and violence keep harming the Central African Republic after disputed elections, while foreign powers such as France maintain their military presence in the former French colony. Welcome to Africa Today. I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya. In this episode, we'll try to find out details of the underreported conflict in the Central African Republic. We'll ask, what do the people of the Central African Republic want? And give you a little history about the nation suffering under the iron hand of foreign forces. In the second part of the show, we'll look at the harrowing bloodshed in Mozambique and its impact on the daily lives of people. Stay with us.
CAR on Path to Chaos. The political opposition has rejected incumbents' re-election, and six powerful armed groups are now united to give Bastanar Chung Tadera a hard time after being declared president for another term. There were also reports of voter intimidation, but the government and some international observers said the election has been held properly.
The members of the Security Council recalled that it will be up to the Constitutional Court of the Central African Republic to proclaim the final results. They called on all political actors to resolve any electoral disputes peacefully and in accordance with the laws and constitution of the Central African Republic. They also called on the government of the Central African Republic and the entire political class to engage in dialogue to promote national stability.
The opposition party called for an annulment of the election, arguing that voting did not take place in many areas. France has meanwhile sent warplanes for various missions. We are joined by Lawrence Freeman to take a closer look at the situation. Mr. Freeman, first of all, what is France up to in the Central African Republic?
The French involvement is very difficult, problematic for the country, because the history of the Central African Republic was that it had to liberate itself from the colonial press of France in 1960. And the French did very, very little, nothing, to develop the nation. When the nation achieved independence, it almost immediately went into a spiral of violence and coups and other policies, and the people of CAR, Central African Republic, have really never been able to develop their country.
Thanks for that, Mr. Lawrence Freeman, and stay tuned. We have much more in store for you.
Allegations of ballot disappearance and other irregularities elongated announcement of the previous victory gained by Tadera in 2016 after a turbulent coup. Hundreds of thousands were unable to cast their vote in areas held by the opposition. The opposition forces launch attacks on the capital Bangui and other areas held by the government or foreign forces.
The enemy is composed of rebels from all over the Central African Republic, coming from the borders of Cameroon, Chad, Sudan, the Fulani in the interior of the country, the anti-Balaka and the Gabaya majority military, including gendarmes and police. They are all in this coalition. Their size is about 9,000 men. Their intention is to overthrow the government in place and force the population into submission in 3 days.
Over 100,000 people have been forced out of their homes across the country. And this is the situation the president has to deal with. For now, Mr. Tuadera looks set to be holding on to power, but will the opposition tolerate? Mr. Freeman, how do you see the future of the situation in the Central African Republic?
Well, we have to start thinking long-term about the future of the country. And the future of the country will not be solved by military. We have to get to the point where the various opposing groups in the country realize that it's in their best interest to work together to fight to struggle for the development of the nation as one country and one identity. And that's difficult, but it's possible to get people to realize that and drop the military confrontationist tactics and find a way, even if it's uncomfortable, for all the people of CAR to join together for the national development of their nation.
Thanks for that, Mr. Freeman. And as you say, unity is key to the future of the Central African Republic.
The impoverished nation lives in one of the most mineral-rich countries in the world. Central African Republic also remains one of the most underreported regions in the world.